And what I shall do is I'll introduce each guest to you, have them come on very briefly just to say hello, and then we'll move on to the next guest. Then I'll come back, and we'll get a statement from each guest individually before we really start the roundtable discussion. Unlike our important roundtable discussion last Thursday on 9/11, I think this one will be a bit more calm. So I don't think we'll have four people battling away like we did on our last one. Important last week, but let me tell you, I was in the middle of it. I felt like a referee who got punched all over the place. I was exhausted. Mike Heiser received his Ph.D. in Hebrew Bible and Ancient Semitic Languages from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He has earned two M.A. degrees in the fields of ancient history from the University of Pennsylvania and a Biblical Hebrew and Semitic Languages from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mike's graduate work has resulted in his ability to do translation work in more than a dozen ancient languages and dialects. For the past 11 years, he has taught theology, biblical studies, biblical languages, and world civilizations. He now works for the Logos Bible Software Company that specializes in software that analyzes the ancient biblical Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek texts, as well as texts in other ancient languages. In addition, Mike is a member of several scholarly societies in his field, the Society of Biblical Literature, the Evangelical Theological Society, and the Near East Archaeological Society. Boy, they're trying to tongue-tie me. And the Institute of Biblical Research, Mike Heiser. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hi, George. Good to hear your voice again.
Pleasure. And it was nice meeting you last week on your brief tour of Los Angeles.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
I enjoyed that. I'm enjoying the fact that you're part of this panel tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Hugh Ross launched his career at age 7. He went to the library to find out why stars are hot. Physics and astronomy captured his curiosity, and he'd never let go. At age 17, he was the youngest person ever to serve as director of observations for Vancouver's Royal Astronomical Society. And with the help of a provincial scholarship and a National Research Council fellowship, he completed his undergraduate degree in physics and graduate degrees in astronomy. The NRC also sent him to the United States for postdoctoral studies at Caltech. He taught courses and researched quasi-stellar objects, or quasars, some of the most distant and ancient objects in the universe. Today, he directs the efforts of Reasons to Believe, an institute founded to bring to the foreground the relationship between scientific discoveries and the Bible. Hugh Ross on the panel tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Hugh.
Hello. Good to talk to you again.
You too. It's been a while, huh?
Yeah, it has.
Coming up on 2 years in just a few months, so time flies by. It's good to have you back with us, Hugh.
Well, thank you.
David Flynn completed his education at Carroll College in Montana, and he created the Watcher website. David's website is a repository for research dealing with UFOs, the monuments of Cydonia on Mars, angels and aliens, and end-time prophecy. David has written popular articles on Mars and of the biblical significance of the Cydonian monuments. His decidedly alternative views on Cydonia have been presented on television programs such as Strange Universe and the PAX TV's Encounters with the Unexplained, What is Really on Mars? Hi, David. How are you?
Good evening, George.
Good to talk
with
you.
Great to be here.
And you were on the week after Hugh was, back in October of 2003, so you're coming up on your 2 years.
Yeah, that's true.
Good to have you with us. And, of course, none other than Richard C. Hoagland, founder and principal investigator of the Enterprise Mission, a public policy and research group that have been investigating the scientific possibility of intelligently designed extraterrestrial artifacts across the solar system for the past 10 years. Richard has previously served as museum curator of astronomy and space science. He was a space science advisor to Walter Cronkite and CBS News, and head of the special projects at New York's Hayden Planetarium, the NASA consultant to the Goddard Space Flight Center. And in addition, Richard is the author of The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever, and winner of the Engstrom Medal for Excellence in Science. And he put this roundtable discussion together with producer Lisa Lyon. Hello, Richard. How are you?
Good evening, George. It's great to be here.
My pleasure indeed. Before we get a statement from each guest, Richard, why don't you kind of give us a capsule of what we can expect tonight?
Well, I don't think I'm going to get my dinner from Hugh yet. I don't think he's willing to concede our little bet in Wisconsin. But I do know that I can see a big smile on Mike's face because Mike Heiser and I and Robin on a trip to Roswell, what was it, two and a half years ago?
2 years ago.
Cooked this thing up on a very long trip down through New Mexico to the UFO capital of the world. And amazingly, when Mike got back to the University of Wisconsin, he actually made it happen. And we all got together for that conference on a, was it late October, early November, after morning and afternoon?
Mm-hmm, late October.
And we went on for something like 13 or 14 hours nonstop.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And, you know, everybody can see this on TV. But we actually had an extremely good time, and we had an extremely provocative and extraordinarily intriguing discussion, certainly for me. And I'm really happy that most of our guys, except, you know, Paul couldn't make it, but most of the guys wanted to show up tonight and go into round two.
Well, that's great. I'm looking forward to this. You know, a number of topics, as you know, Richard, fascinate me, but none more than talking about extraterrestrials, God in the universe, in man, and you put it all together. You guys, by the way, did a great job on the DVD series. Quite frankly, I'm very surprised that people who were experts at what you all do, not knowing that you were all experts at putting together a pretty good piece of television as well. So I was very, very impressed with what you all did with that. It's so sad, however, tonight, Richard, as you know, after you let me know about the very sad death of Cheryl Jones's father at the age of 96.
Yeah, it really is such a tragedy because Cheryl has worked day and night with both her parents to make their, you know, end years comfortable and pleasant and interesting. And she's been there in Tennessee with them by their side for the last several years. And it's such a shock tonight to learn of the passing of her father, because it was Cheryl who came to Wisconsin and donated her time and was our master or mistress of ceremonies. And it just pains me to think of her tonight in her hour of loss. And I'm the one thing that's a comfort to me is that when we put things out for this audience, you know, this audience responds, and I just want you to say a little prayer for Cheryl's dad tonight, because he's certainly listening in, and he's certainly interested in what we're going to be discussing.
We'll add my favorite aunt, too, Richard. She passed away last night.
Oh, my God.
And my mother's sister. She had a stroke a couple months ago, and she finally succumbed. And the family is now doing what it needs to do, but she was in a somewhat coma state for the last couple months, and finally she passed away. So very strange. All this would happen at the same time with us.
Yes.
Mike, let's start with you if we can, and then we'll go to you, Hugh, you, David, and you, Richard, and then we'll begin the true roundtable discussion here, which will be free-flowing. But, Mike, why don't you give us just an overview. This title, God, Man, and E.T., what does that mean to you?
Well, I think the... I think there's an important intersection, actually more than just one intersection, between the subjects that you commonly think of when you think of extraterrestrials, the whole UFO ET issue. Whether we like it or not, no matter what side of the question you're on, it sort of takes you into the bigger picture questions. And Richard's fond of giving the nod to traditional religious, especially Christian audiences, for being able to think of the big picture. And I think he's on target there, because it does take you into questions of, well, if there is an extraterrestrial life form out there, especially if it's intelligent, what does that mean for the way we look at ourselves, the way we look at perhaps the origin of life in the universe and on the planet and so on and so forth. So these subjects take us inevitably into these questions: our place in the world, our place in the universe, and of course, creation, creator, evolution. What are the processes, if any, that got us here? Because those who would adopt what I guess I'll call, for lack of a better term, an extraterrestrial worldview, they're going to be inclined to at least consider, if not adopt, some form of panspermia, either that life is seeded just randomly and by natural processes, or deliberately, as Francis Crick advocated. So you get into all these questions, and when we were taking our little trip down to Roswell, Richard and I got to talking about the context, the bigger picture context. And I told him, and I think this is sort of what started it off, was that, you know, Richard, if you're right in whatever sense, in some sense that there is, you know, design, whether it's his hyperdimensional model, which I confess to not be able to understand, but if you're correct, then this screams design. It doesn't scream randomness and purposelessness. And I said, now that is something that a Christian audience is definitely interested in, because we view the universe and life as the product of an intelligent designer. And we might disagree on, you know, how that works, what that means. There is disagreement within the Christian community, and Hugh can tell us all about that because he faces that on a regular basis. But, you know, this is a sort of a common footing, maybe a toehold, where these kind of questions that Richard deals with can overlap with things that the Christian community is thinking about. And I think it would be a good opportunity for a dialogue. And it's just sort of developed from that to the conference in 2003. And now we're having another one come November on the West Coast to really get into the question of origins, and trying to concentrate a little bit on Mars because that's in the news. And if there's life there, what does that mean? To sort of narrow the scope a little bit. But here we are, and I think it's a good place to be because all sorts of questions intersect here.
Dr. Hugh Ross, you've got some things to say about God, Man, and E.T. Go ahead.
Yes. Reasons to Believe is a team of scientists that has been building a testable, falsifiable, and predictive creation model. And, for example, I've written three books, The Creator and the Cosmos, that talks about the origin of the universe and the design of the universe, and how the more we learn about the universe, the stronger becomes the evidence that it was produced by a supernatural, transcendent creator. And then a colleague of mine, Fuzz Rana, a biochemist, and myself, a few months ago, brought out a book called The Origins of Life, where likewise we demonstrate that the more we learn about the chemistry of life, the more we discover that it demands a supernatural origin, not a natural origin. And in September, we're releasing a book on human origins called Who is Adam? That likewise builds a testable model for human origins. And a book I wrote a couple of years ago, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, I looked at the whole issue of extraterrestrial life, making the point that it's certainly within the purview of a supernatural transcendent creator to make extraterrestrial life, but that the laws of physics would not permit those life forms to travel from their planetary system to our planetary system. So on that basis, I am a skeptic about the idea that aliens have ever visited our solar system.
Very good. Thank you. Well, this is going to be one perfect night tonight. David Flynn, God, Man, E.T., your thoughts.
Well, George, when I actually hooked up with the team here, I was pretty surprised that...
I can barely hear David.
We can, Richard, so and you two are sharing the same bank, so you just have to listen as closely as you can.
Okay.
And I was pretty surprised, the vast array of people who attended. I originally came with this idea that people had two major questions, and if they were coming from the Christian perspective, they were going to be asking, what is the UFO phenomenon all about, and how does it fit into the scripture? And the second question was, the monuments of Mars. Richard's book has done something, I think, that has riveted people to this idea that there may be a possibility that intelligent life may have lived, flourished somewhere else close by. And because that prospect has raised its head, there's a debate going on that hasn't been going on for many hundreds of years, because it's not a theological faction that said, we insist there's the extraterrestrial life, it fits into Scripture, and there's another side that says it doesn't. There's a phenomenon that's happening right now that are pulling people out of these Christian and other denominations, other religious groups, mm-hmm. and they're starting to critically analyze the information that's coming in. So those are the two main points, and it's phenomena like your show that's actually brought this to the forefront. So when I went to the God, Man, E.T. conference, I addressed those points, and the farther I looked into them, and I was amazed by Richard's book. He sent me into an inquiry of the Bible to find out what the heck these things were on Mars because they were so compelling. I couldn't just dismiss them, and I couldn't argue them away. So the more I looked at the Genesis 6 scenario, and that's the scenario where maybe the most obvious extraterrestrial story in the Old Testament, in the Bible, where beings from heaven came down and actually dealt with and interceded in man's affairs and actually bred and started a breeding program with human beings. That's the most extraterrestrial event you can look at. And there seems to be a definite Martian signature over the whole thing, both in name, both in place, and both in the modality of it. So I've continued to work on this research, and I've actually found that this Martian signature exists in the actual UFO phenomena itself. And there's been researchers who've been able to figure this out that I think have gone by the wayside just because they were pioneers in their field. So I've been bringing this together, and I hope I can get some of it inserted in these conversations because it does follow a major theme, and it does follow the theme of Mars.
Well, and I'm sure you will, David, and I've got to say what you will hear tonight with these four guests will be things that will, in some cases, startle you. Some things you may agree with, other things you may not. But more importantly, you are going to get four specific views of their thoughts of God, man, and E.T. And Richard, I'm going to save your remarks for right after the break. But I've got to, you know, in all my several years now of interviewing you and talking with you, I don't think you and I have ever talked about God, man, and E.T. in one swoop. You know, we've talked about planets and Mars and things like that, and you're going to mention a few things that you've found out for us. But you and I have never had this discussion, and it's fascinating for me to get your views on this.
No, we haven't. And it's interesting because we're both, as I said, in Wisconsin, recovering Catholics. So we probably should have between now and then, or then and now.
And are you able to hear, did you hear most of David?
It was very faint, almost down on the noise. I had to really listen. I missed about every fifth word.
Okay, you're going to have to, because you two are sharing a bank there, you're going to have to really listen when he talks. And, of course, everybody's website linked up right now with their names on coasttocoastam.com. So it's very easy to get to enterprisemission.com, reasons.org, which is for Hugh Ross, MikeKaiser.com, and David Flynn's WatcherWebsite.com. All those, they're right there. Take you right to it. They are all fascinating. And we'll come back in just a moment and get Richard C. Hoagland's statement on his thoughts of God, man, E.T., and then we'll continue with our roundtable discussion. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, our special roundtable discussion. But before we hit our network break, let's get Richard C. Hoagland's statement now about God, man, and E.T. How did this interest you, Richard?
Well, this really started shortly after I got into the whole Sidonia problem when I was in California, and we were brought into SRI International, which is the Stanford Research Institute, and we set up the first independent Mars investigation to follow on the work of DiPietro Molinar way back in the 70s and early 80s on the potential, likelihood that the face and the other structures around it were artificially designed. Mm-hmm. We brought this study into SRI, and what fascinated me, and we did months and months of the first computer conference, long distance, among a bunch of scientists on this subject. We called it the Martian Chronicles in honor of Ray Bradbury, who you allowed me graciously to talk to a few days ago. And what came out was this remarkable religious strain to the conversation. It tended to reveal people's deepest beliefs, their deepest aspirations, how they projected their religious and spiritual experience onto objects on another world. And one of the key players, who was a scientist with SRI, turned out to be an absolute dyed-in-the-wool fundamentalist Christian who tended to put that kind of a gloss on everything we said and did and wrote. And it was a tremendously educational experience for me because up until that point, I hadn't realized how profoundly this kind of a potential discovery of real ruins built by real folks on another planet would reach out and touch every human being on this planet at that level of belief and the transcendent. And it wasn't until many years later when I discovered the so-called Brookings report, the Brookings document, that I realized that back in the 50s and 60s, a bunch of blue ribbon experts from a wide variety of specialties, including Margaret Mead, the anthropologist who I worked with when I was at the Hayden Planetarium, were anticipating that this would be the kind of third rail of the conversation, that the interface between God and man and the extraterrestrial question was the singular most incendiary question, bar none, not even the science, not even the epistemology, but the belief systems of everyone who came to the table. And I must say that that experience has been amply confirmed over the ensuing years.
Well, I want to thank you at this point, and I'll do so at the end of the program, for putting together this panel. I appreciate it. Richard C. Hoagland, when we come back, we will chat with each individual for just a bit. I want to get their take on what they think God is, what they think man is, what they think an ET might be. And then, of course, we'll just open them all up and see what happens. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This quick note, by the way, because I'm getting several fast blasts from Eugene, Oregon, out there at our fine affiliate KPNW. Somebody there is editing their sports clips over the show, so you're on the air. Just want you to know about that. Let's Mike, let's go to you first. I'm going to just give you the word, and I want a definition.
Hold on, George. I want to see if the Cubs won.
Yeah, really. God. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think, as Jesus said, God is a spirit and doesn't have a body or gender or anything like that. This is, again, standard Christian fare and standard Judaism as well. I think he's a spirit. I think he is a person. He exhibits attributes of personhood like self-awareness, introspection. He concerns with ethical and moral behavior, righteousness, justice, that sort of thing. I also think he's separate from creation. I think that's a philosophical necessity. I also think, and of course I'm not going to even attempt to go into this area because we have Hugh here, but something like the Big Bang, shows that there was a singularity point. There was a point at which everything came into being. By definition, I think philosophically, you have to have an entity, a being outside of creation to create everything else, because you can't have creation create itself before it was created. So I think God is all those things. He's a spirit. He's a person. He's the creator. Beyond that, I think we're getting a little too theological.
Mm-hmm, right. Hugh Ross, do you subscribe that that God is this omnipotent being out there in the universe that has created all things?
Yeah, I'm agreeing with Mike's definition of God. What we do at Reasons to Believe is marshal the scientific evidence for that position, particularly through the space-time theorems of general relativity. And the power of those theorems, they only depend on two assumptions: that the universe contains mass, and that general relativity reliably describes the dynamics of the universe. Now, today, both of those things are beyond doubt. General relativity ranks as the best proven, most exhaustively tested principle in all of physics. And what those theorems tell us is that the cause of space, time, matter, and energy must be an agent capable of working beyond matter, energy, space, and time. And probably the big breakthrough of 2004 and 2005 is the proof that dark energy is the dominant component of the universe. And the significant thing about dark energy is that in order for the universe to possibly contain physical life, the constant governing dark energy must be fine-tuned to better than one part in 10 to the 120th. And that's where we get our scientific evidence that God not only transcends space and time, he must be a personal being, because we can compare that level of fine-tuning with the best fine-tuning that we humans manifest, which is a machine built by Caltech and MIT physicists that can make measurements to one part in 10 to the 23. Therefore, the transcendent causal agent beyond space and time, at a minimum, must be 10 to the 97 times more intelligent, better educated, more knowledgeable, and better funded than those Caltech and MIT businesses. And, you know, when you talk about power, knowledge, creativity, intellect, those are attributes of a person.
How about you, David Flynn? Do you believe in God?
Yeah, I do, and I agree with both Mike and Hugh. And, you know, God is omnidimensional, omnipresent, omniscient. He exists outside the creation. But he also has an aspect of having inserted his influence into creation in a material way. And he has the power of existing, since he is outside of time and space, simultaneous with human beings from their beginnings, their present, and their future. And it's that aspect, I think, that's most fascinating about him when it comes to when you throw in into the mix Bible prophecy, you throw into the mix the Bible history. You can look at a continuity between the two and a repetitiveness between the two. And as far as reinventing the wheel when it comes to God, it makes sense to fall back on what's been done. There's been so much in history and the early church fathers and extra-biblical works that are done, the writings and studies on the Torah by Jewish sages. It's pretty easy to get a handle on who God is because he really has put forth the information in writing.
How about you, Richard C. Hoagland, specifically? You do believe in God. What do you think God is?
Well, you know, if I approach this scientifically, belief is not part of the discussion. It's finding out. And as I've said in many forums, including at the conference, to me, the exciting thing is the journey. It's that we actually have the tools. We have the technology. We have the required theories. We have the bright people that are able to lay out roadmaps so we can ask better and better questions. And the ultimate destination is the prime mover, the what created everything we see. And I do agree that philosophically it's kind of hard to get creation itself to create itself. But in terms of how many intermediate steps there are between us and the ultimate creator of everything in the universe, I have a feeling it's a lot more complex than in most of the discussions that take place on radio or television about, you know, God and man. I think there's a lot of intermediaries that have had a hand in our being here that we want to get into tonight.
I think you're right, Richard. I'm going to open up all the phone lines right now. And, without stepping over each other, I know it's pretty difficult because you don't see each other. Just tread lightly as you join the discussion and talk. Why is it? And I'm not going to address this to anybody, but one of you can pick this up first. Why is it when we talk about extraterrestrial life out there in the universe, so many people who are supposed to be religious just tend to shy away from that, almost as if they believe that only us, that we are the only ones in the universe. Why is that?
This is David. I believe it's just a lack of information. That's what my website and my book have been trying to iron out for Christians specifically, and anybody else who wants to actually look into it from the secular realm. But if they knew what the Bible was saying exactly, they wouldn't have any problem with what was being discovered on Mars, and they wouldn't have any problem with what's happening in the air around our atmosphere, around our Earth, because there's a specific explanation for all these things. But it is difficult because the Bible, maybe up to 200 years ago, wasn't available in the vernacular, wasn't available in the common tongue. And just 100 years ago, it wasn't really feasible, unless you had a lot of money, to go someplace and actually become a scholar in what the Bible said. 100 years ago, though, James Strong actually cataloged the entire New Testament and actually put a lexicon in for the Greek and for the Hebrew, and you can go back and actually find what the words are actually saying. So that's a big problem.
Isn't it true that if you truly look at the Bible and make these logical interpretations, it clearly spells out that we've been visited before?
Well, this is Hugh Ross speaking. The Bible does talk about God creating two different kinds of intelligent beings, physical beings that are confined to the space-time manifold of the universe, namely us, and angels that are not confined to the space-time manifold of the universe. And I think the reason why so many Christians hold the view that we're the only intelligent physical aliens in the universe is when you look at what the Bible says is the purpose for his creating the universe, he would only need one physical intelligent species to fulfill the seven different purposes he's outlined in the Bible for creating the universe.
You know what baffles me? That, you know, here you are, you're all experts at what you do, scholars, theologians, scientists, researchers. Do you ever, all of you collectively, just stop sometimes to try to figure out, what the heck are we doing here?
All the time, George, particularly over my last 20 years. And I must say that the answers to me have gotten more ambiguous as opposed to clearer. I mean, a little later on in the program, we're going to talk about some specific data that we have come across in the last 2 or 3 days and put together and have posted on the Enterprise website tonight. And frankly, it's going to blow Hugh Ross away, either positively or negatively, but Hugh is going to leave us tonight a changed person for us having discovered it. But for me, I don't yet know what it means. As I get deeper and deeper into this extraordinary adventure that started when I looked at a set of photographs taken by NASA of what looked to be ruins on another planet made by intelligent beings, i.e. Mars, I am less and less certain of all kinds of things. And to me, that's a good place because, you know, you've been touting that I, you know, recently passed a very major birthday.
Yes, I sure did.
And normally when people get to that era, they're kind of fixed in their personal view. They kind of think they know how the universe works. And to me, the extraordinary thing is that there's so much left to learn and to unlearn that I thought I knew before.
So true. So
George,
true. Yeah.
George, I'd like to jump in here a little bit.
That's you, Mike Kaiser?
Yeah, that's okay. Me. I would echo, some of what I've just heard in the last few minutes. I think that, in a general sense, I don't wonder why we're here. I think the scripture is pretty clear that we're here to represent God on the earth in whatever we do. That of course doesn't violate some moral principle. We're here to figure out what makes the universe tick as well, and we've all been given different sets of gifts to steward the earth, to perpetuate the human race, to again master our little corner, our little niche, whatever it is that God has put in our hearts to investigate and to learn and to grow therein. So in a general sense, I don't wonder. Of course, for each individual, there's the question of how do I live that out in a very specific way. So I think that's what Richard's talking about. But as far as why, going back just a few seconds here to why Christians tend to have this narrow view, I do agree with Hugh that part of the reason is that the Bible doesn't specifically mention extraterrestrials. It mentions the two, life forms that he mentioned. And with Dave, again, a general lack of information, I can't argue with that either. I think on the other side, and understand that I do, intellectually, I can separate the more popular ideas of ufology from the bigger question of extraterrestrial life, even though they tend to get lumped together. But that part of it has scared the church away, because if you look at contactee literature, for instance, there is what I call a hijacking of Christian doctrine. Jesus was from Venus and that sort of thing. So that kind of thing, the links between ufology and spiritualism and theosophy, Christians tend to look at that and it creates unfortunately a link in their minds. And I'm not saying that the link doesn't exist. I think in a lot of that literature and a lot of those experiences, it does exist. But the question of whether there can be an extraterrestrial intelligence doesn't have to go down that road. But often, people of faith look at it like that's the only road.
Is there a distinct difference between belief that there's extraterrestrial life out there in the universe or that it's visited here? Because you, Hugh, you believe there is life out there, but it just hasn't come here. Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute believes there's extraterrestrial life out there, but it hasn't come here. Does that matter at all?
Well, just to get my position correct, I do believe that there are the remains of Earth life on all the solar system bodies. I mean, it's about 200 pounds of Earth material for every 100 square kilometers on Mars and 20,000 tons for every 100 square kilometers on the moon. So in that sense, I am a believer in extraterrestrial life, but I believe it's simply transported Earth life. I'm quite skeptical about the idea that there's physical life on any other place in the universe that's indigenous. And as far as Earth-transported life goes, the astrophysical mechanisms would only permit those remains of Earth life to be transported over interplanetary distances, not interstellar distances. Likewise, if God were to create physical life on some other planetary system, there's no astrophysical mechanism to bring it here. And in terms of directed panspermia, the laws of physics wouldn't allow physical aliens to travel in spaceships with life on board where that life would survive. On the other hand, if you're willing to talk about angels and demons who are not restricted by the physics of the universe, that's a whole different question.
And we will get into that as well with just about a minute or so left. Richard, let me ask you, first of all, I'm getting a lot of interest on the Godman and ET DVD. Can you tell me how one can obtain it?
Well, you can call an 800 number. There are literally tonight operators standing by. I've always wanted to say that. And now I get an opportunity.
Now it's yours.
And the number is 1-877-345-6222. That's 1-877-345-6222. You can also go to the Enterprise website, and there's a banner at the top there, and you can click through. And as I said, we're only going to be able to touch the surface of this extraordinary 13 hours that we all shared in Wisconsin. And, you know, what we have a chance to do is to illustrate everyone's perspective. So there's very extraordinary animations and graphics of, for instance, Hugh Ross's ideas of the new heaven and the new earth, and, you know, Michael's incredible scholarship into the angel scroll and things like that. And, of course, David's work, which I'm hoping he'll get into tonight a bit, as the contact between potentially Cydonia and places in the Mediterranean, which most people had never heard of or ever seen the data. So when you look at the DVDs, you get a chance to look at 8.5 hours distilled down of the kind of conversation that we're going to be getting into this evening.
Well, let's do this as we get going in the roundtable discussion. I'll have each of you tell us about your specific area of expertise, why you do what you do, and have the rest of you react to it. Like you, David, of course, you have done a lot of work, as Richard has, into Cydonia and the mysteries of Mars. I'm very curious about your take on that. And then we'll get everybody to react to that as we continue with the dialogue. So why don't you start, David, on just your main approach here.
Okay, well, thanks. That's a great place to start because it revisits what I was saying about the Martianness of Genesis 6, the scenario of extraterrestrial life of some kind, not humankind, coming here and starting this strange breeding program with humanity. This immediately calls to mind the abductee phenomena today. And if you look really clearly at the Genesis 6 scenario, you'll find that it was what is called the sons of God that came down to Earth and saw the daughters of Adam. Now, that first sentence, the daughters of Adam, is a clue to the connection, because Hadam actually means redness or red earth. And a lot of scholars would say that, well, that's because Adam, of course, inside of her body is red and we have blood. But so do all mammals do, fish do, birds, many different kind of animals do. So there really isn't any consistency with that idea. But modern Hebrew actually has a name for the planet Mars, Ma'adam, using the same exact word in the actual descriptive term of the planet. The next thing that comes to mind, though, is that out of the three major monotheistic religions, two of these religions, Islam and Judaism, actually contemplate that Eden itself wasn't on Earth, that Adam and Eve were actually created somewhere else in paradise and then brought to Earth. And I give the example for Islam. Surah 223 actually talks about the Garden of Eden existing in the fourth heaven.
Now, are you saying, David, that they were space travelers or maybe genetically altered and dropped here? What were they? Who were they?
Well, this is this, the continuity here is this idea that Mars has something to do with this interaction in Genesis 6.
All right.
And actually, you have the name for mankind itself, the first man, connected in this etymological way. If you look at the name of the Watchers themselves, it's really interesting because there's some extra biblical books that have been written about them. Enoch is a really good example, the pseudepigraphic book of Enoch. He talks about them as shining, the shining ones. And he also calls them watchers. And you can find that idea of watcher and shining ones repeated over and over again in the earliest history of the most ancient civilizations we know. Sumer, for example, the builder gods that came and built their civilization, the founding gods of their culture, are called Eri. That means watcher also, and shining. The builder gods of Egypt are called Nit-Eru, the same root word is there as the suffix of that word, and it means the shining ones, literally. If you go get a good Latin lexicon and look up the word for to gleam or shine, you'll find the letters M-A-R, which is the root for Mars itself. And the word for watcher in Enoch, Eri, is actually transliterated directly into Greek as Arios or Ares, which is the Greek version of Mars. So that link has been overlooked, and in some cases it has been absolutely comprehended but covered up and veiled. In addition to that, you can actually find a word that sounds so close to the name of Mars in the Bible. It's only listed one time. It's listed in Judges 23. And it has to do with a place called Meroz that apparently was cursed by God. It's called the Song of Deborah. And she's singing this victory song after she had been witness to the destruction of an actual man from where Canaan was, a place that's north of Israel. He was destroyed by some sort of extraterrestrial intervention, a cataclysm that came from on high. And there's a curse that goes with this word Meroz. It's listed one time. The extra-biblical texts and actual written studies on the Torah and the Talmud have actually analyzed this word. They don't list any place in Israel for it or in Canaan for it, and they actually go so far as to say it's a place in heaven that's inhabited. And Eliyahu Horowitz in 1797, who wrote the Sefer HaBrit, which is the Book of the Covenant, actually had said it was a planet where these people or these beings exist. And what's even more provocative about the text in Judges in the Bible is that the curse goes along that they didn't fight with God against the armies of Sisera, who are against Israel, and they didn't fight against the Giborim, which is a word that's used in the Old Testament, which fits right into Genesis 6. It means giants. It was a word that was attached to the watchers. It was a word that was attached to these beings that came down. There's so many different points to the idea that Mars has had some influence over Earth at a distant time, and one of the most provocative, I think, is that the actual place that they came down was called, in the post-flood times, Cydonia. It was actually a Cydonia on Earth.
Yeah.
And so if you actually look at that critically, you can find that there's some big connections. The actual word that was used for watcher in the Bible and also in the Book of Enoch, Ayer, is spelled exactly the same way as its use for city. These two words are almost perfectly identical. And I'm sure Michael has something to say about that. But the idea that building cities and these watchers are connected in such an integral way immediately calls to mind these ideas that there may be physical structures on Mars, artificial structures that are built there. And
go ahead, David. Finish that up.
Yeah, so if you ask the question, did watchers build cities, then absolutely the ancient texts say they do. Etymologically, the connection is there. And you have to actually look at the old texts and not reinvent the wheel to analyze these things, because there really isn't a lack of information about this.
All right, Richard, because you have talked about Cydonia before, let's get your take on what David just said.
Well, you know, what's so really affirming is to have someone who comes from the biblical and Christian tradition basically follow in your footsteps and find all kinds of other really cool support for things that you suspected but didn't have the background or the time to look into some 20 years ago. I mean, when I started looking at these objects on Mars and these NASA images and coming to the realization after I set up the independent Mars investigation team and then the other teams with colleagues and peers, that we were really looking at real things. Somebody had built this stuff. And, of course, the central effigy, the central icon, is a mile-long, 1,500-foot-high humanoid face. It just, you know, screamed out there's possibly a connection to Earth. And I actually, in my book, The Monuments of Mars, I call that chapter The Possible Terrestrial Connection. Well, I am just tickled to death that David has done the scholarship and the homework and has found extraordinary evidence, which he's laid out both in his own presentation at Wisconsin as well as in his own book. And I want to give David a plug for his book because it's a heck of a book.
For sure.
You can't say in a biblical discussion a hell of a book, so I've changed that. Anyway, he really has done yeoman service in, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's, and has done it at an academic, rigorous level to where if any objective observer looks at this, they've got to have some extraordinary questions about, okay, not only is there quite likely stuff on Mars, but that stuff was built by somebody who has some connection to us, somehow came here, somehow imbued our culture, our most ancient cultures, with their presence, their philosophy, their universal view, and left us with a legacy which demands we find out ultimately what it means.
Well said. Well said. Mike Kaiser?
Yes, George.
Now, with David talking about this, a little different than what you talk about, but what are your thoughts on what he just said, what Richard has just echoed?
Well, I think that, how can I say this? There are, what Dave said about Meroz is interesting. I have not heard him comment on that specifically. And there isn't a whole lot of biblical information on that. It is sort of enigmatic when it comes to Semitics and biblical commentators and whatnot. The one thing I would say, though, is the Hebrew spelling of Meroz does not correspond to the etymology that Dave gave, the M-A-R. It just depends on what he's looking at. I don't know what he's looking at. If there's, you know, Dave, you'll know what I'm talking about here. If there's an Aleph in there, because in Meroz there's not.
Why is that important, Mike?
Well, because a lot of these arguments, and I'm not saying, I don't want anybody to misunderstand. I'm not saying that all of Dave's arguments are based on etymologies. There's not. But
hey,
you
guys are tame compared to last Thursday's roundtable discussion.
What? Etymology is something I'm sensitive to because etymology can often lead to interpretive fallacies because they're just because, you know, think of English, just because a word has the same consonants does not necessarily mean A, it comes from, one comes from the other, or B, that there's a shared meaning. Yep. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't.
Mike, just to clarify, I wasn't making an etymological connection between Meroz and Mars.
That's what I was wondering.
Just actually A and Yad Resh sound spelling of the word for watcher and city.
Okay.
That's the closest one. The other ones I was talking about is just being evidence for the Jewish sages in the past who say that they hold out for this idea that there is life in outer space close by.
Right, gotcha. Yeah, and then Dave's certainly correct that's a very old tradition. I'll say this, and I don't mean to be, you know, cold here, but sometimes the rabbis didn't really need a biblical reason to make a tradition. You know, if it sounded cool, you know, that was good enough sometimes. And since I'm a text person and specifically ancient, you know, I tend to put less stock in what the rabbis say. However, that said, I'm interested in what the rabbis say because sometimes you may not agree with the connections the rabbis are making, but they can put you on really interesting trails. One thing about what Dave's doing, now Dave's using the term extraterrestrial. You know, having talked to Dave, I don't think that he's using that term the way some others might use it as far as a a being that's bound by time and space,
right,
lives on another planet,
right,
and that kind of thing. I mean, he's using it more broadly as not of this earth, that kind of thing. I don't share the Adam red and the Adam man connection. Same consonants, that's true.
Could you believe, though, Mike, that the Adam and Eve were space travelers and somehow came here?
No, I don't see any evidence in the biblical text for that.
Right.
What Dave's getting at, though, is this idea that I will say this: Eden, yeah, you know that there's a geographical description in the Bible for that, and so everyone assumes. Note the key word: assumes that is a literal place. You know, we had people go look for it and all this kind of stuff. I personally, I'm not saying it's not a literal place, but if you look at the description of Eden in the light of Israelite and broader ancient Near Eastern religion, that description matches the description of the place where the gods live, the place where, you know, God takes up residence with the gods of his council. In other words, it could very well be a description of a, you know, quote unquote spiritual or ethereal place. Now, I do think that that it was somewhere on earth because of the command to subdue the earth and multiply and all that stuff, all that kind of thing. The context indicates that, but I don't think it can be necessarily restricted to that. So that's a long way of saying, you know, some of what Dave says, I agree with some of it. I'd have to take another look at, and some of it we'll probably have to agree to disagree.
All right. What about you, Hugh Ross, your take on David Flynn's statement?
Well, you know, there's a verse in the Bible that says everything must be tested. Hold on to that which is good. And, you know, that's kind of the hallmark of our Reasons to Believe ministry, is we have our testable creation model, and like every day we post a new scientific discovery on our website that gives more evidence for the God of the Bible. And you can see several postings there in the past several months on the subject of Mars. And what we're discovering is that the more we learn about Mars, the more we're discovering it's hostile for the support of physical life. And, you know, we can put all these ideas out to in more significant testing. You know, let's look at Mars in a little more detail in the next several months and see what happens. Likewise, the rest of the solar system. I think a real good way to get a handle on this is to look at extrasolar planets. More than 160 have been discovered now outside of our solar system. But everything we're learning about these extrasolar planetary systems tells us that they're a long ways from having the conditions necessary for the support of life. And so we can put to the test by looking deeper into our galaxy and the universe whether or not we really are alone, or is there the possibility there could be sites for the support of extraterrestrial life. Again, you can go to our reasons.org website. The latest evidence shows that the probability of finding a life site somewhere else in the observable universe with the capacity to support physical life is less than one chance in 10 to the 282. That's 282 zeros after the one. You want to get a handle on that. If you were to fill the entire universe with dimes, or there's no space between the dimes, that only adds up to 10 of the 82 dimes. The probability of finding a site without invoking divine miracles for a place where life could possibly exist is 10 to the 200 times more remote than the probability you could find one marked dime blindfolded out of a pile of dimes that fill the whole universe. But again, we can put this to the test. I'd be willing to bet that 6 months from now, that probability will be even more remote than it is today.
George?
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
I'd like to jump in and ask Hugh a question on Dave's behalf.
Sure, go ahead.
Hugh, do you think that, again, having talked to Dave, I know he's thinking in terms of non-human entities when he uses the term extraterrestrial. Do you think that it's possible that a non-human entity could build a structure? In other words, does a non-human entity have creative power not to call things into being, but to take pre-existing material and make things?
Yeah, if you're willing to invoke angels that are not confined by the laws of physics or the space-time dimensions of the universe, yeah, they can do things like that. But from a biblical perspective, I mean, they primarily work in the spirit realm rather than the physical realm. They can invade our physical realm, but they tend to do so very ephemerally. So it's just a brief interventions. And everything we see in the Bible and everything we see in terms of the scientific evidence tells us they don't leave behind physical artifacts.
Well, Hugo, I'm surprised you said that because, I know you're an ordained minister, and so I know that you would look at the Genesis 6 scenario and understand that the flood was brought on by an intervention, an actual invasion of something that wasn't human that damaged the earth through their physicality, what they did, what they actually
achieved. I agree with that. I've written about that in my book, The Genesis Question, that the Nephilim, I would argue, are indeed these fallen angels that came down and violated the physical restrictions God had placed on the angels. You know, they went outside their estate, as you see in the book of Jude, and did physical things that God did not want them to do, and so they have now been put into check. But, you know, I don't believe there are any physical remains of these creatures. The Nephilim did wander the earth, but we have yet to find a skeleton. Certainly in terms of the UFO phenomena, they crash into the earth, but they don't leave any artifacts or debris. Therefore, I'm not expecting them to leave anything on the surface of Mars either.
When we come back, Richard C. Hoagland will be up next. And we're back with Hugh Ross, Mike Kaiser, David Flynn, and Richard C. Hoagland with our roundtable discussion. Richard, you wanted to react to what they were saying, and then we'll take your specific statement on your thoughts.
Well, first of all, I'm pleased to see that Dr. Ross is still dragging out his huge, humongous numbers, because frankly, I don't think they mean a thing. We don't know enough about the universe to be able to project all the laws, all the incredibly interconnected complexity of physics that is not going to be invented for 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years. I just think that that degree of certitude in science as opposed to, you know, spiritual matters is just misplaced. And, you know, you can drag out all the, quote, evidence and support of those numbers that you want. The fact is that we are continually surprised in science every single day by things we simply did not know the day before. And I'll give you one crystal clear example. A few months ago, you and I discussed, George, the methane discoveries on Mars.
Right.
And the fact that it was getting more and more difficult to ignore the possibility that they were produced by some form of Martian life. And as we look at the data, we now see that there's this huge discussion going on in the geological community between the lifers at the recent ESA conference in Europe, when they polled the scientists gathered for the Mars Express conference. I think it was a few months ago, 75% felt that there was evidence of current life on Mars. Now, this was up from 5% only 10 years previously, based on the accumulation of data, the methane, formaldehyde, where the methane follows the water and all that. And they're looking at a model which says there's little microbes underground generating these gases, and they're leaking to the surface and are detected by spectroscopes both on Earth and in spacecraft orbiting. So in only 10 years, you have this dramatic shift between, you know, the majority thinking that there was never anything on Mars to where the majority now thinks not only could there have been, but they could still be there, meaning little beasties, little microbes. Now, the opposition, the non-lifers, have dragged out, you know, things like olivine and dry chemistry to try to refute the idea that there is some kind of living process. But this is a dynamic in the scientific community which is healthy, and ultimately it will fuel more missions, and we will resolve this, and we will have the answers probably, you know, maybe within the next couple of years, maybe toward the end of this year when the Marsis radar goes into operation and we find out how much stuff is lurking underground. But certainly within the next 10 years, we're going to know. To come back to, you know, my central tenet, which is evidence trumps theory. We've got ruins on Mars. I will categorically stand by that statement tonight that we have had 20 years now of peer-reviewed discussion, writing, publication, analysis, debate, controversy, political hijinks, NASA trying to hide pictures, put out weird pictures. And the bottom line is, for those who have looked at the data, you know, and the public polls of people who just looked at the pictures, there is overwhelming consensus that, yeah, there's somebody was once there. Now, the most interesting thing to me, and the reason we're all gathered around this, you know, national campfire tonight called Coast to Coast AM, is because when you look at the central object of the ruins, it is a humanoid face. Now, when I was a good Catholic, brought up, you know, listening to priests and going to school and taking rote by the sisters, you know, I learned that God said in his infinite wisdom that he would create man and woman in his image. And that's kind of stuck with me, and Mike, I know, is going to disagree with a literal interpretation, and his arguments are pretty cool, so I'm looking forward to his response. But the bottom line for me is that when you find a humanoid face, an image, lying on a place where it does not belong, in a context of a set of ruins that do not belong, A, they were built by somebody, okay, and B, those somebodies probably had bodies. They probably had physical form. They probably lived in three dimensions. They were not angels. They were not demons. They were not, you know, extra-dimensional creatures. They were here in our own dimension on a nearby planet. And because of the humanoid nature of the face, I have been impelled to look and see whether there was a connection to us on this planet. And as you know, George, my preliminary conclusion is that ultimately we are the Martians. Somehow we are connected to whatever this extraordinary thing was that happened on Mars and then was blown away by some huge planetary catastrophe. And with that, I'll give the floor to someone else.
Okay, very good. Now let's move on to you, Hugh. I want to get your thought. You fascinated me in October when you were on, 2003, and you're doing so now. Is there a difference between you and Hoagland? I mean, did you get along at the God, Man, and E.T.? And I mean on a intellectual basis?
Well, I think we got along on a personal level, but we certainly have our intellectual disagreements. I mean, you know, two of the design characteristics of the universe is that the universe must be extremely homogeneous and uniform for any kind of physical light to be possible, which is why I believe there are no surprises in astrophysics. The physics we see locally is going to be the physics we see at great distances. In fact, we astronomers can see all the way back to the creation event, and we don't see any special physics. We don't see any discontinuities. And the very fact that we're talking to one another over the phone lines by itself means there can't be any discontinuities or surprises in the universe.
But the dark energy was a tremendous, incredible, shocking surprise and still is.
I don't think so. I mean, it was something
They thought so.
It's something we've been anticipating ever since we had the measurements accurate enough to really discern the second-order effects in the expansion of the universe. As soon as we had that, we said there's something happening. I know astronomers were predicting dark energy as far back as the early 1990s. No, it is an amazing discovery, and the fact that it's so incredibly fine-tuned is certainly unexpected. And, you know, we're using that as evidence for this supernatural design of the universe. In terms of the methane on Mars, I mean, you go to our reasons.org website, you'll see that there's been a number of papers published literally in just the past 6 weeks that demonstrate that methane is best explained as having a natural cause, not an organic cause, an inorganic cause. By the way, there is the possibility that some microbes could be transported to Mars in a viable state. It's not a high probability, but that probability does exist. As far as the humanoid face on Mars, I've worked with these JPL physicists and astronomers. I've worked with people who have actually seen the collection of photos. We have a JPL physicist that's on our Reasons to Believe staff, and I can tell you from firsthand experience, there's no possibility that there's a conspiracy going on at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. You got 4,000 engineers and scientists there, and the working environment is such that it wouldn't be possible to cover up something of that nature. I would encourage your listeners to go to the JPL website and see this so-called face on Mars for themselves. It only looks like a face at low resolution. You look at the high-resolution photos, and you discover that the formation there is not nearly as impressive as the face that you see on the rocks in, say, New Hampshire. and another one that's in British Columbia that we all know is simply a natural thing that happens to look a little bit like a face. So, and again, there are more photos being taken. Let's put this to the test. We can test Richard's claims by doing more research on, you know, what's, you know, every day they're taking photographs of Mars, and we can tell.
Well, this is Dave again. It just brings to mind what's on the Earth, though. If we get back to the idea that there was a pre-flood civilization, that if you come from the Christian theology, you have to believe because the flood wiped it out. And the flood wiped it out because of the intercession of these angels. And that's from the, you know, mainstream Christian viewpoint of what it was that actually intersected with Earth at that point. And they created an actual hybrid being using humans. So there were beings, but they weren't exactly human, and they weren't exactly angel. They were something else. And every ancient civilization, hands down, if you can go back far enough, will say, these are the things that taught us how to be civilized, how to build, how to make cities. And the evidence is actually still intact. You can go find these places, these megalithic ruins, ruins where today we can't explain how they were built. I mean, a really good example is Baalbek in Lebanon right now, which was formerly known as Sidonia. And by the way, it was also called Phoenicia, which is another word the Greeks gave it, which means the red men, red place, something like that. Anyway, Baalbek, Sidonia is some place that is woefully ignored by archaeologists. And now it's almost impossible to get into because they have the Hezbollah actually have a training camp right on the site. But there's a place called the Baalbek Trilithon. It's built with megaliths of limestone that are 14 feet tall by 10 feet wide by 72 feet long. These weigh on the order of almost 1,000 tons. They're laid about 20 feet up in the course of masonry to form a incredible foundation for which the Phoenicians built on, and the Greeks and the Romans, the largest edifices of their civilization. And almost in a contest to see who could build larger edifices. But without actual exception, you actually can go and look at the information from history about this place, and it says that the Watchers build it, or the Nephilim build it, another word for the giants that were the progeny of these Watchers humans.
Well, is it possible that you're all right, that we've had visitations, but, you know, Hugh believes in the angelic and the demonic type of visitation, and we've had ET visitation with physics that might be unknown to us right now? Who wants that?
Well, I'll take that.
All right.
I think that it's possible that all these things could be their own separate categories. You know, I've said that before on Coast. I've said it in different talks. I don't see why that's an impossibility. You know, it's something that would have to be, you know, tested insofar as you can do that, because I do believe there's a difference between things being possible and things being plausible. But I, for one, of the four here, am willing to consider that these things could be their own categories.
Okay. How about you, Richard?
Well, I start with the premise that you got to follow the data. Theory is great. I know there's this group of geologists who are kind of doing a counterattack on the methane and claiming that it's produced by natural chemistry. And frankly, it almost reminds me of the flat earthers who, when, you know, the first ideas that the Earth was round were circulated in the intellectual community, there was this counterattack by the flat earth guys because they really couldn't stand the idea that there's life out there. And some of these geologists, yes, and they do work for JPL, can't stand the idea that there could be life anywhere but here. Now, I don't think that Hugh is in that position. I think Hugh sincerely believes, from his religious perspectives, that we're it. But I don't think we're it. In fact, this new chapter that I've been writing on the Iapetus story, part 6 of, you know, Moon with a View, we have some data in there tonight that when you go to the Enterprise Mission website, enterprisemission.com, and look in the Iapetus box at the top of the page, which is right under the Godman ET banner, and you click on part 6, there is some extraordinary data. It is so mind-blowing, it is so revolutionary, that if it is true, it is the nail in the coffin for the Hugh Ross perspective. And I will summarize very quickly, and then after the break, we can maybe get into more details. Many years ago, Francis Crick and Leslie Orgel published a paper in Icarus, which is a major planetary science journal, called Directed Panspermia. The idea, because they were both molecular biologists, and Crick, of course, is the Nobel laureate who in 62 was one of the co-winners of the Nobel Prize for the discovery of DNA, when he kept looking at the problem of creating life on Earth, he was correct in that it got more and more difficult for, you know, this honest, gentle scientist to actually see a way to naturally create DNA and living organisms here on this planet. And so what he said, ultimately, was that that you would basically, well, here, let me quote him exactly. He says, an honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have to be satisfied to get it going. Now, he said that in a book called Life Itself, published by Simon & Schuster in 1981. But in 73, even before he made that rather definitive statement, he and his colleague, Orgel, were looking at something called directed panspermia, which basically was that if you couldn't satisfy the equations for the random accumulation of nucleotides and other organic molecules to create life here, maybe conditions elsewhere in the galaxy, in other galaxies, were more propitious, were more conducive to allowing that to happen, which means those guys would have, you know, originated and evolved first at the dawn of the universe. And then they would have looked around and said, oh, my God, it's pretty lonely. And at some point, if they lasted long enough, they would have built spaceships. This, again, is Crick's idea. And they could have sent spaceships carrying tons of microorganisms in all different directions to basically seed the other lifeless worlds, either in their vicinity or in the next galaxy. And we're talking immense amounts of time for this to happen because of the travel times without, you know, super light conditions. The point is that this was a very serious, world-class, Nobel Prize winner, molecular biologist who basically proposed seriously in the most serious planetary science journal going, Icarus, founded and edited by Carl Sagan, that life here may have come from somewhere else. Well, the bottom line tonight is that if you read part six of the Iapetus series, the Moon with a View series that we've been working on for months and months and months, we believe we have found remarkable supporting evidence for Orgel and Crick's directed panspermia idea. And it has to do with this bizarre place orbiting Saturn called Iapetus and the discovery many years ago about a mile down under South Africa in primeval rock ledges laid down almost 3 billion years ago of little tiny capsules, little spherical capsules. And there's pictures on the website in this article showing them being held by one of the museum curators there in South Africa.
Are those the ones that Cremo also talks about?
Those are the ones that Cremo was talking about and I sent you the other night.
Yes.
They look like biological dispensation capsules. And they look like they were the seed carriers, because when you crack them open, there's this spongy organic stuff inside, and the casings are harder than steel. And if some intelligent advanced civilization from some other galaxy or some other star system developed first and had billions of years of looking around and was lonely and wanted to create more companions, more brothers and sisters, more spiritually connected consciousness, that would be one mode that it might follow, and that's why this data is so stunningly important to this conversation. And again, it's evidence we can pursue and test and understand ultimately. It's not just theory.
George?
Yeah.
Do we have time to jump in before the break?
No, we're right at it right now, Mike, but we'll come right back at the top of the hour. It is amazing how fast this night is going by. We will do that. I've always believed the opposite, that the angels and demons were not what they were, but they were extraterrestrials, and people misinterpreted what they were. And even though I do believe in angels, make no mistake about that. I'll be back in a moment with our panel, our roundtable discussion on Coast to Coast AM. Mike Kaiser, right before we broke away, we were ready to say something, and we didn't have enough time for you.
Yes, thanks, George. You know, Richard's setup was just wonderful. Just what he said is the very thing that led to the formation of the second conference this November. The organizer came to me. He had watched the DVDs from the first conference and said, hey, could you help me do this? He told me what his emphasis, what he wanted. And it's this stuff. We wanted a conference where specifically, we did this the second time around, we wanted to give directed panspermia its day with, you know, new data that is being used to support that view. We wanted to give undirected panspermia the floor. We wanted to give a completely naturalistic viewpoint. We have Seth Shostak this time in this mix, and Hugh Ross and his associate, Fuzz Rana, who's a chemist. And we wanted to have astronomers and chemists focusing specifically on the new things that are coming out, you know, things that Richard alluded to and more. But the setup was great because that is exactly where the conference is heading this time. And for listeners, I don't know if the other guests, the other guys who participated in the last one were aware of this, but the first one, Richard and I did a show to introduce the idea of the conference to listeners. And it sold out very rapidly. We had to turn over 200 people away. And if listeners want, you know, to see this happen again, to sort of get everybody under the same roof and just kind of watch the fireworks, I'm a little selfish. I like to watch it myself.
Why are you going to bring Philip Plate there with Richard or what?
Well, we don't have Philip Plate. We have Seth. You know, and it was interesting trying to get Seth, you know, to participate. But he's well known again to the Coast audience, and of course another diametrically opposed view. So we were actually looking for what we thought were the four major views on origins, and to try to put, you know, everybody in the mix and just kind of see what happens. So if the listeners want to find out what the lineup is, what the topics are, they can go to my website and they'll get the schedule and registration information. There's a number too that they can use. We can give that out toward the end of the show.
Please, okay.
But this is exactly where we were headed, and Richard's comment about, you know, this being, I'm sure Hugh disagrees, the death knell of the Hugh Ross view. But
I don't think it's the death knell of the Hugh Ross view.
Well, he said it was the end of the Hugh Ross position. That's the kind of thing
I said
that would
was
be great
proven.
To see happen at the conference.
What'd you say, Richard?
The interaction.
I said if it was proven.
If it was proven.
Yeah, science is all about proof, and Hugh is a lot about theory, and I'm just saying, let's follow the data. Let's follow the proofs.
Well, can I jump in at this point?
Yeah, you better.
Richard, there's a couple of misrepresentations there. My skepticism about extraterrestrial physical life is really based on my science, not my religion. I've written a number of books on this, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men and the Crater in the Cosmos. And also, I've personally attended these Origin of Life research conferences where directed panspermia was discussed, and the real context is this. This came out at the last Worldwide Origin of Life conference. First day of the conference, they ruled out planet Earth as a site for a naturalistic origin of life. And the second day, they focused on Mars and found that Mars was much more hostile than the Earth was. Then they went to Titan and Europa and other solar system bodies, ruled that out, and then they looked at natural panspermia, the idea that life might have traveled to Earth through interstellar dust or through interstellar rocks, and that was shown to be impossible. On the last day of the conference, they said, well, we've ruled out everything except aliens purposely dropping life on planet Earth with spaceships, but it was really tongue-in-cheek, and I think that's really the way to interpret Francis Crick, too. This was a tongue-in-cheek comment, actually expressing the frustration of Origin of Life researchers and trying to explain the origin of life from a naturalistic perspective, because what happened at the conference is they said, well, of course, if we ruled out all of these natural options, then where does these aliens come from? I mean, the same arguments against the naturalistic origin of life would apply to the aliens. And as I've pointed out, mites in the sky and little green men, it's physically impossible for aliens, even if God were to supernaturally create them somewhere else, to travel through interstellar space.
Well, what if, Hugh, what if they bend time and space, like wormholes and things
well,
that...
Well, if you're talking angels, that's different, because they're not confined by the physics of the universe.
Well, I agree with that.
Okay. Well,
in
terms of physical aliens...
There's some real data that confabulates what Hugh is saying, and that's simply this.
What'd you do, get a new phone?
No. Well, you mean for the one last week? Yes.
No, no, I mean the one now. Sounds like you're in an echo all of a sudden.
Oh, I'm sorry. There. Is that better?
What'd you do?
I have it on speaker. I'm sorry.
Richard?
So I could hear David.
How long have you been doing David. This show? Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, in the January-February issue of the peer-reviewed Journal of the British Interplanetary Society, four physicists, Bernard Heisch, I think maybe Hugh knows him, James Dierdorf, Bruce McAbee, and Harold Puthoff, published a remarkably interesting paper called Inflation Theory Implications for Extraterrestrial Visitation. And the idea was in the 30 years since Francis Crick had talked about directed panspermia as a wild idea, if we concede Hugh his point, what we now have is a stunning array of new physics which makes going between stars or galaxies or universes much more probable than it was 30 years ago. And this is what Heist said in his Space.com interview. He says, what we have done here is somewhat of a breakthrough. We pulled together various recent discoveries and theoretical issues that collectively point to the strong probability that we should be in the midst of one or more huge extraterrestrial civilizations. That's the backdrop to tonight's conversation. The conversation has moved on from Francis Crick 30 years ago, and at these Origin of Life conferences, if they're not aware of the current physics, then they're not
Richard,
really holding a scientific conference on the probabilities of directed panspermia.
That Origin of Life conference, half the participants there were physicists and astronomers, and you need to understand, like, for example, in journals like Physics Letters B, what physicists often engage in is what they call unreasonable physics. Physics they don't believe, but they try it out because the mathematics is interesting, it's fun. Bottom line, what we have to look at are the models that are reasonable from a cosmic perspective. If you're going to invoke negative energies or violations of the second law of thermodynamics, you can make all kinds of imaginative things happen, they don't pertain to reality.
Who decides what's reasonable?
Okay, the physicists themselves decide that. I mean, for example, if you look at my book, The Creator and the Cosmos, I've got a section on what is called unreasonable cosmic models. These are models that physicists agree amongst themselves do not pertain to physical reality. On the other hand, they're fun things to do because of mathematics is so imaginative, and there's a possibility of application in other disciplines. I encourage that kind of work. I think it's good to do. But we got to be careful not to interpret it as something that actually applies to physical reality.
Richard?
Yes.
Do you know Leslie Orgel?
Do I know him?
Yeah.
No, I don't personally know him.
Okay, I was just wondering, because I actually contacted him for the second conference and asked him if he still holds his directed panspermia view. He said he did, but he had less confidence in it, and he didn't want to represent that view at the conference, so I'm wondering what you think of that.
What do you mean? Why does he have less confidence? What happened?
I don't know. That's why I was wondering if Richard knows him, because he
well,
just
I know him. I heard him speak at the Origin of Life conference, and he was not promoting directed panspermia. I mean, what was encouraging to Fuzz Rana and I, who were attending the conference, they were ruling everything out, including directed panspermia, really leaving us with only one possibility, a supernatural creator. In fact, there was a consensus that came out to the effect it's either something that transcends the laws of physics, like the God of the Bible, or we're looking at some completely unknown law of physics that violates the second law of thermodynamics. This is something that Stuart Coffin, for example, is promoting, but the problem with that proposition is it would be impossible to hide that fourth law of thermodynamics from the astronomers' telescopes. They would be bound to see it, and we don't see it.
Hugh?
Yes?
I have a devil's advocate question for you.
Sure.
I get people ask me this, and my first thought is, why don't you just ask Hugh? But I figured I have you here, so I'll ask you. The fine-tuning and the anthropic principle have been critiqued by secular philosophers, and they reason like this. If God loved creating intelligent life so much, why did he make the conditions for it so dramatically unlikely? How would you answer that?
Well, I would answer that God has more than one purpose in creating the universe. It's not just that he created this physical universe to provide us with a home. He also created it so that we could view the entire history of the universe. It's one of our ways we can discover God's attributes and characteristics. He put us in a special location, a special time. It's designed to bring about a rapid, efficient conquest of evil. It's designed to display God's glory. It's designed to be a teaching instrument. There are seven different purposes revealed in the Bible for why God creates this universe. And when you combine those seven purposes, it puts enormous restrictions on the kind of physics that you would need. Now, I do believe that God is not confined to make only one universe. Mm-hmm. After all, the Bible talks about a brand new creation that will replace this universe once evil has been finally and permanently conquered and removed. But given these seven different purposes that God has for creating the universe, I'm not all surprised that it's extraordinarily fine-tuned. For example, the optimal design to provide us with a home is identical to the optimal design to provide us with a viewing platform, which is identical to the optimal design to bring about a rapid, efficient conquest of evil. Now, that's very unusual. When we human beings design things, we have to compromise. You cannot have a fuel-efficient, high-performance car engine. You have to compromise. What we see here is no compromise at all, and that lack of any compromise at all explains why we have this incredible fine-tuning. In fact, I would predict that in the next 12 months, we're going to find far more fine-tuning than we know about today.
Why? Why in 6 months?
Well, what we've been documenting over the past 30 years is that the evidence for a supernatural, transcendent creator designing the universe for the benefit of humanity gets about 10 billion times stronger every 6 months. So I'm confident that if you wait 6 months, we'll be able to give you at least 10 more zeros.
Richard, you'll love that, won't you?
Well, I will follow the data. And what I'd love to see Hugh and me join, and we did this in Wisconsin, we kind of made a bet, which I think is a dinner in L.A., as to whether there's going to be an announcement sometime that there's really life on Mars.
A dinner in L.A. is way too close to me. Sounds like you want me to pick up the tab.
God, George, I didn't know you wanted to come, but if you want to do that. Anyway, from my point of view, we're closer tonight to the announcement of life on Mars than we were in 2003 when Hugh and I made the bet.
Yeah,
and
the bet is for indigenous
life. Absolutely, you know, in awe of the possibilities for this Marsis radar. And it was extremely clever programming for you to have Linda on in the first hour discussing the Marsis radar, because that has been delayed over a year. There are some of us who believe, suspiciously, there are political reasons why they didn't want to turn that thing on. And it's now being delayed till December because they have to create politically the right context for what they're going to find, which is, A lot of stuff under Mars that they will interpret as liquid water boundaries, interfaces, lots of pockets where little guys could live. More interestingly, I believe that radar will find evidence of what we call the buried cities, the anomalies that would not show up on the surface because they're covered by enormous amounts of sediments from the catastrophe. You know, things like Cydonia, but a lot bigger, that are buried underground that would be available only to radio waves of the right wavelength that could penetrate the surface materials. And one of my key reasons for thinking that, well, I actually have two. One is, if you go to the NASA archives in Washington, and we'll post this paper at some point on Enterprise the next, you know, week or two when I can find it again, there is a survey of the Soviet space program written by one of the leaders of the entire Soviet space effort. And in the beginning introduction, and this is a document in the NASA History Archive, he makes extraordinary allusions to underground cities on Mars confirmed by the Phobos data in 1989. It's the most astonishing document you've ever read. Number two, we had an inside source who still is an engineer at JPL, I can't give his name because we don't have permission, but he's working on staff. And he directed us a year ago. He said, forget the cameras, forget the spectrometers, look at the Mars Express Marsis radar. It's the most extraordinary possibility for confirming your model that we can imagine. And he left it there. So I'm basically expecting in December you to come and collect on my bet.
All right, let's hear from David. David, yesterday I had a guest, John Rhodes, who has a theory of reptoids, believing that they live within the planet Earth and that the UFOs are coming not generally from above, but from within. What do you think?
Well, I was ready for that question, George. I thought it was really provocative because it fits right into the etymology of the Watchers, the whole paradigm that's in Genesis 6 again. And I'm grateful to Richard to bring us back to Mars again, because this all fits together. There's an etymological connection between the idea that an alien might take on a draconic or reptilian appearance. And in Greek, draconi is a word for to look or to gaze, which is basically another version of to watch. And it's also interesting, if you look in the context of the Greek New Testament in Revelation, a future prophecy that concerns a being from heaven, a vision that St. John had of a dragon that was red. If you were to take that and translate it, transpose it into Hebrew, say, you would have to use, and Mike disagrees with me on this, but the idea that red would be a word like Adam, and dragon would conversely change to watcher. So you would have another allusion to this idea that's been etymologically inserted into Genesis 6. Further, there's these connections that Mars has with the Earth in the UFO phenomena that's contemporary. And this is something that was done in a study by Jacques Vallée, a pioneering ufologist. I think it was a book, Challenge to Science, in 1966, and a paper he published, too, called UFO Enigma. And what he had done is found a connection between the orbital pattern of Mars and Earth. And he realized, after taking data from 1947 to 62, that all the UFO flaps had a correlation between close passes with Mars at perigee. At epigee, the reports of the UFOs in North America, at least, would drop off, and then when Mars would come close again, they would build up again. So he tried to find any correlations between other planets. He looked at Venus, he looked at Jupiter, even the Moon. There was no correlation between any other planet except for Mars. This is verified later by Nigel Bundell and Roger Bohr in their book, The World's Greatest UFO Mysteries. They realized that in the two greatest American UFO flaps in 1967 and 1973, Mars was also at perigee. So there's connections that are left by the wayside because there isn't a unifying sort of theory of Mars' connection to the Earth. Even Mexico City flap, one of the most incredible flaps of UFO phenomena in our time, has a Martian aspect to it. It was in 1991, I believe, that August, they had an eclipse of the sun. And so
it was July 11th.
July 11th. And this naturally brought astronomers from all over because it was an easily accessible place. And Mexico City is the most populated, densely populated city in the world.
Hold that thought, David. We're going to take this quick break. We'll come back. We'll let you wrap up, finish that up. We're going to talk a little bit about parallel universes because maybe that's an answer to some of these questions as well. And as promised, even though we don't have a lot of time, I will open up the phone lines, and we'll take a few calls as well for our four guests. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, this will be our final segment with our roundtable discussion on God, Man, and ET. We'll take some of your phone calls as well right at the end of this program. We'll talk about their various websites and what they really have as true expertise. And also, I'll give them all a chance for a brief statement to wrap things up. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Come back, final segment, and your phone calls and our guests. David, let's have you finish up what you were talking about. Quick question to all of you about parallel universes, then we'll take some calls.
Okay. I was just remembering that Mike Heiser has one of the most excellent articles on the precedent for why an alien would take on a reptilian form. It's his Reptoid Seraphim articles on his site. But getting back to the UFO flap in 1991 in Mexico City, this occurred during a solar eclipse, but it occurred over 19.5 latitude, and that's an angle that Richard Holcomb's been talking about is recurring over and over again in the internal and external geometry of the Cydonia region. That by itself is provocative. But the history that goes into this area itself is incredibly connected to this idea of Mars, because as I was saying before, in the Watcher scenario from Genesis 6, there was every reason to believe that etymologically there's a connection to Mars through it. In Mexico City, Tenochtitlan was the place that was actually founded in 1325, and it was the war god of the Aztecs that actually caused the Aztecs to move south from the area where Texas was. And in 1325, they found this place in Mexico City, which is basically a swamp, but it is over the 19.5 latitude area. And I thought it was also very interesting that the actual Aztec calendar, Mayan calendar that they inherited, was calibrated in the most obvious date that's pointing out sometime in our future. And I think I've heard you talking about that.
Oh, yeah, 2012, my favorite end date or beginning date.
It is very well certain that the Aztec civilization was founded at the 19.5 latitude in 1325 A.D. If you count between 1325 A.D. and 2012, you have 687 years, which is exactly the number of days in the Martian year. If you count from 1325 to 1991, you have 666 years, which is very provocative when it comes to the idea of the end times, the prophecy that goes along with it, and what's been written in the New Testament and Revelation. And then 2012 has been calibrated to our Gregorian calendar for the last point for this. And the Greek translation of the Old Testament actually has translated the word watcher through Gregory or E-Gregory. It actually means to watch. So even the calendar that we are using today refers back to the watchers. And it's connected in all these subtle variations and these veiled variations, but they can actually be parsed if you have, like I was saying, that that theory of Mars as a connector.
All right, Mike Heiser, do you believe in parallel universes, that there could be many out there, hundreds, thousands perhaps?
Well, I can only answer that by saying that I've read that possibility. I can digest some of the physics. I think I would defer the gist of the question to you, but I would say this, theologically, God's omnipotence certainly encompasses that. I think Hugh was leaning in that direction before. So, sure. I mean, that's something God can do. I don't know if, in fact, that what the theoretical or the mathematical possibilities are, though.
Okay. How about you, Hugh?
Well, my book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, that wormholes are mathematically possible to take you from one space-time realm to another one in this universe, but physically they are impossible. In the sense that it's not possible for a physical entity to travel through a wormhole, even though you can mathematically formulate them. They're just too narrow, and the possibility of getting one black hole singularity to line up another one is statistically indistinguishable from zero. If you're referring to the multiverse hypothesis, the physics can generate a multiverse when the quantum space-time foam. But unless you're willing to invoke completely different laws of physics in space-time realms, the universes that you can bud out of the space-time foam must return to the space-time foam in something under 10^-122 seconds, and certainly the universe in which we live is much older than that. Now, if you're talking about something completely beyond our space-time realm, general relativity tells us once you've got observers in Universe A, its space-time envelope cannot overlap the space-time envelope of any other possibly existing universe.
How about you, Richard C.? Another universes out there?
Well,
I would say yes, and I'll tell you why. If you go back to the paper I talked about before by Bernie Heisch and Dierdorf and McAbee and Puthoff, they say, and I'm going to quote, it has recently been argued that anthropic reasoning applied to inflation theory reinforces the prediction that we should find ourselves part of a large galaxy-sized civilization, thus strengthening Fermi's paradox concerning where are they. Furthermore, superstring and M-brand theory allow for the possibility of parallel universes, some of which in principle would be habitable. In addition, discussion of exotic transport concepts such as traversable wormholes now appears in rigorous physics literature. As a result, the we are alone solution to Fermi's paradox, based on the constraints of earlier 20th century viewpoints, appears today to be inconsistent with new developments in our best current physics and astrophysics theories, and those are four guys in the thick of it.
All right, gentlemen, let's take a few calls here, and then get ready for a statement from each of you about things we've talked about tonight. Let's pick it up by going to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Go ahead. Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Ron from BC.
Hi, Ron. Go ahead.
Hi, just first of all, I'd like to say excellent show, gentlemen. I'm an honorable, and I've been listening to your program for many, many years. Keep up the good work.
They shall. Go ahead.
Richard, have you ever heard of Martin Riley? I believe he was on Art Bell's show about a year and a half, 2 years ago. It's concerning the
Riley Martin, the fellow who said he was taken to Saturn.
That's right.
Yeah, Riley Martin's his
right.
Name.
The guy from the South who had this remarkable childhood in Mississippi, and then he says he was taken to this super space station orbiting Saturn.
He's got an extraterrestrial friend. He says.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Named Ken.
Tim.
I
Tim.
Believe.
Yeah, I heard. Yes. I heard both shows that George did with him.
Yep. What's your question?
I was wondering if I could get your comment on that, and because I found it to be very believable. It was quite a remarkable show, and I was wondering maybe if you would have him back on.
Oh, he always comes on time to time, and I'll let you get your answer on the radio.
Okay. Quickly, he comes across as very believable, sincere, a guy who's not making it up, who really believes what he's saying. The question is, where is he getting his information, and is someone feeding him information that he does not have the technical background to discern which is real and which is not real? And I frankly have no information. All I can do is gauge his sincerity, and I think that he is very sincere. Now, what's remarkable is that his appearances on Art and George's show was before we found this stunning thing orbiting Saturn in these close-up Cassini images.
That's true.
Iapetus. And for God's sake, we've got to get Cassini back there to get better data. And when you read Part 6, everybody, on the Enterprise Mission website, you'll see why there are stunning potential new answers if we simply follow the data.
When he started talking, Richard, about being in a spaceship that took him to Saturn, and then he said it circles Saturn, and then you were able to post that picture on your website, and there was that thing, whatever it may be.
Yep.
I couldn't believe it.
Isn't that astonishing? Yep. Well, that's the kind of universe that we live in. With all due respect to Hugh, the surprises, the real surprises, are much more exciting than the numbers.
First time caller line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Walter Roth, and I'd like to ask, I'm from Dallas. And I'd just like to ask you, I'd like to center on the spiritual side of things.
Okay, go ahead. He's listening.
And I wonder if you would agree that when we accept Christ in our heart and study the Bible with faith in God, that he will teach us and that our minds will be regenerated and that we will see the spiritual battles going on all around us and our loneliness will go away.
Well, I don't know about the loneliness. What do you think, Hugh?
Well, I would agree with what he's talking about, that's really what the Christian message is all about, that when we recognize that we cannot live up to God's expectations, that we need God's help to turn from our evil ways, His Holy Spirit comes in and begins to transform us. And one of the things we notice is we begin to think differently. We begin to take on the thoughts of God. Our minds literally are renewed. That's what happens when a person gives their life to Jesus Christ. And the feeling of loneliness goes away because you begin to, at that point, have a personal relationship with the Creator himself.
I just looked at the clock, and we've only got about 7 more minutes. So even before we take any more calls, I want to make sure you all get a statement in here about God, man, and E.T. and what we've talked about. Mike Heiser, you go first, okay? A couple minutes, max.
Well, I think, you know, what we've heard tonight is just indicative of the bigness of the question. You know, if there was extraterrestrial life, the question would naturally be, how did it get here? And that takes us right into the question of origins, and that's where we want to focus the next event. And, you know, we plan to have events after that as well. I've actually having a contact at Harvard. We may actually get out to the East Coast sometime. We don't know. But I just think the bigness of it all, the big picture questions have just come out very evident in the conversation. So that's what I think the importance is. And are we going to wait to the end to give the number, George, or should I give it now?
Give it now.
Okay. For those who want to register for the conference, you can go to my website. The number that I'm going to give is on that site, gives you all the information, but here is the number, 360-647-9037.
David Flynn.
Thanks, George. I was just thinking how the secular mind sometimes will have a problem with the idea of what's happening on this planet as being something special, something unique because of humanity. And the scripture points out that this earth is unique not so much from a human-centric view, but from a God-centric view. It's important because God has chosen this place to do something remarkable. And Ephesians, and Mike Heiser brought this to my attention the last conference I was with him at, but Ephesians 3:9 talks about how the principalities and powers in heavenly places are actually being shown some wisdom of God through what we're doing here and through what God's doing with us. And so in that one phrase, it actually explains that man has a purpose, and it's actually to demonstrate God through us to these entities in the universe. And from that perspective, the earth takes on incredible significance.
All right. How about you, Mr. Richard C. Hoagland?
Summation statement. I'm just incredibly thrilled that this conversation is proceeding. When I started looking at this stuff 20 years ago, it was so difficult to get anybody to publicly even, you know, raise an opinion or express an opinion. And now, look at this. You and I are lying down like lambs and lions together, discussing diametrically opposed points of view, but respecting each other's right to have that particular point of view.
You agree with that, Hugh? You can wrap this up before we take a final call or two.
Well, I think we live in really exciting days. I mean, every day there's 5 or 10 new scientific discoveries that shed light on some of the things we've been talking about tonight. I mean, that's what we do at Reasons to Believe. We post a scientific discovery every day that allows people to put these different ideas to the test. And incidentally, they can get that as a free daily email. And if they want to talk to us about it, every Tuesday we do a 2-hour live talk show on the past week's scientific discoveries and how we can use those to test different beliefs on creation, evolution, extraterrestrials, anything that people want to talk about. That's at reasons.org.
Okay, great. Richard, I'm going to keep you for a few minutes. David Flynn, Hugh Ross, Mike Heiser, thank you so much being on this very important roundtable discussion. Appreciate
it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, George.
My pleasure.
You're very welcome.
You know, Richard, first of all, thank you for putting together this panel. You did a great job for us.
Well, we have a heck of a pool to draw from, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely, indeed. Now, the Complete Six DVD series, again, the toll-free number, there are operators there right now. I have looked at this. And I've looked at all 6 of these DVDs. Very well done. One, and I know it took you a long time, Richard, to put this together with your group.
It took us a year. You know, Laurie Hukol and I worked a year on this, putting the production, illustrating with extreme care, you know, Hugh's point of view and Mike's point of view and David's and Dr. Nelson, who could not join us tonight. So this is a quality discussion, 8.5 hours. I mean, tonight we only had a taste, minus, you know, news and commercials and the other stuff. We've got 8.5 hours of this kind of high-level, really in-depth, penetrating discussion of what it's going to mean when NASA someday announces, hey, guys, we're not alone.
Dr. Paul Nelson, had he been here with us tonight, would have talked about how would we know if E.T. contacted us, huh?
Yep.
This
is a discussion that I said a moment ago, whose time has come. The thing that has bothered me the most over the last 20 years in doing this, with NASA's tremendous recalcitrance, is that no one is preparing, except you and Art, the American people and the larger world, to grapple with this stunning set of discussions. I mean, you can hear the discussion tensions between Hugh's point of view and Mike's point of view and David's and mine. And this is among people who are professionals and who respect each other. What happens when the general population is suddenly confronted with not a discussion, but the facts that either they're here or they were there or we were them or something like that? So I'm tickled to death that Mike has organized another one of these and that we may actually take this to Harvard, because this is a discussion, as I said, whose time is overdue.
The phone number, the toll-free number for the DVD, Godman and E.T., is 1-877-345-6222. 1-877-345-6222. And, Richard, take the next 30 seconds, because I love the way you always do this, and just give me your reaction and tell us about Brookings again.
Brookings basically said that if you find it, we must hide it, because you can't take it. And Art has a number of callers, you know, fundamentalist Christians who, I guess, expressed to him that perspective. And my experience, as you could tell tonight, even with the point of view that Hugh and I expressed on opposite sides of many issues, is that intelligent, believing people who have God in their heart and curiosity on their mind can accept any reality the universe throws at us, including the fact that we are not alone.
Sounds like my dear old friend Walter Sullivan from a long time ago.
Absolutely. Mine too.
That book inspired me when I was a young kid. Richard, thank you so much. I'm going to be on vacation a little bit. I do believe you'll be checking in with us on July 4th to see how Deep Impact reacts, right?
From a secret location.
I love it. All right, take care, Richard.
Have a safe and happy vacation,
thank
George.
You so much. For Nikki, Imbernoni, Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Van Heiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisor, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM.